It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Burial. The final resting place of the man who was the dominant figure in this country for six decades. We were told to come back at 2 o'clock when the cemetery would open. Castro is buried in the same cemetery as Cuban patriot Jose Marti, the government's way of sealing his legacy as an eternal revolutionary leader.
I am from Poland, living in Norway, and I know the Cuban history. I like Fidel, I love him, and I'm here for him.
But critics say free education and medical care have come at the expense of freedom, democracy, and economic progress. Berta Soler is leader of the opposition group Ladies in White.
Oh, my chama.
We march for the political prisoners and for human rights. We have suspended our marches during the days of mourning, but we do not mourn the death of the dictator.
A rally at Santiago's Plaza of the Revolution attracted thousands of government supporters who came to hear Raul Castro. Many bust in and getting a day off from work.
Fidel has not died because he's alive in my heart and in the hearts of all Cubans.
Momento triste.
This is a sad occasion for Cuba and the world because Fidel always stood up for justice in Cuba and around the world.
Fidel Castro famously said that history would be his judge and would absolve him. But with his brother still in power, we may have to wait for that history to be written. In Santiago de Cuba, Elliot Rodriguez, CBS 4 News.
All right, so CBS reporting on Castro's being laid to rest, although I suspect he won't be getting much rest now that he has met the eternal judge of all things. You know, we talked a great deal about Cuba on Friday with Rafael Cruz and also with Chris Farrell from Judicial Watch, who knew the Cuban national who actually tipped the American government off to the fact that there were missiles in Cuba that were going to be aimed at America and paid for it bitterly, 20 years in prison. The Friday show was incredible. If you haven't heard it, please go on our Facebook page, go to the podcast and listen to it so you can understand who Castro really was, because you won't get it from that report. You won't get it from the AP. It's amazing to me the way they cover the brutal history of this man and lie and really, you know, aid this fantasy that he was somehow a great leader when he was, in fact, a murderous, brutal person to even his own people. Ironically, there is a picture in Breitbart this morning, this Jeep pulling the ashes of Fidel. I don't know if it was his body. No, it's just the ashes, but it's a casket. Breaks down in the middle of the street. So this picture is of the soldiers pushing it, which really is, it is really typical of communist governments. They don't produce. They can't make things that work. Russian products during the Cold War used to be a joke because all of their people are workers, you know, workers, but they have no incentive. They're paid low wages. Yes, they get to, you know, live in free housing and they all get the same, you know, $5 a month. I'm being facetious, but they all struggle. They're all poor. They have no incentive. In Russia, there was a huge alcoholism problem. And nobody wanted to work. The potatoes in the field would just rot because farmers had no incentive to go out and farm. And yet I digress. You just have to understand this is a big lie that Fidel Castro was any kind of a hero. It is a big lie. And so please, if you did not listen to that show on Friday, I just encourage you to do that because it really was gripping. And it will help you to understand the truth about Fidel Castro and current day Cuba. All right, well, in a breath of fresh air, President Donald Trump made a speech in Ohio this past weekend. Let's listen.
For too long, Washington has tried to put us in boxes. They separate us by race, by age, by income, by geography, by place of birth. We spend too much time focusing on what divides us. Now is the time to embrace the one thing that truly unites us. You know what that is? America. America. It's America. Because when America is unified, nothing is beyond our reach. I mean that. You're going to see. You're going to see. We're going to have a country that was never so great. You watch, in so many different ways. You hear a lot of talk about how we're becoming a globalized world. But the relationships people value in this country are local. Family, city, state, country, they're local. We'll compete in the world. We want to compete in the world. But we're going to compete in the world where it's a two-way road, not a one-way road. The advantages are going to come back to our country, and they haven't for many, many years. There is no global anthem, no global currency, no certificate of global citizenship. We pledge allegiance to one flag, and that flag is the American flag.
Sandy Rios back with you. That's pretty amazing to me. And you can call that populism, you can call it whatever negative term you want, but is that not true? Are we not allowed to love our own country and to protect it and to protect our own children and have an identity as Americans? Are we not allowed to do that? You know, Europe is going through, it's not just Europe, Australia too, going through its own upheaval of people rising up and saying, no, we do not want this globalist movement. In fact, Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi just lost yesterday in a referendum, and he has resigned already. And now the EU, you know, this is going to affect the EU. There is an earthquake all over the world in terms of a response to what the globalists have tried to do, break down borders, break down national identity, break down stories. I remember reading about this when I first started on radio in the mid to late 90s. And I remember reading about what the globalists in the UN were trying to do about getting rid of what they called the old story, which was, it was code for the story of Jesus. I remember someone briefing me on this and I thought, what? What are they doing? And they wanted to break down barriers, national identity, language, culture. It was just almost too much for me. I couldn't quite comprehend it. And yet I've seen it play out in the last few decades. No question about it. So in a sort of another manifestation of that, a change in things, we will do a show on this, but let me just briefly say that China has received, trust me, most favored nation status, I think because of trade. I think because of globalist corporations and many businessmen listening to me know about this. When we opened up China, when China was opened up to do business with American business, made a lot of money and Americans got a lot of cheap goods. And that's where we are right now. But what happened in terms of the political environment was a country like Taiwan, which was independent from China, fiercely independent and democratic, and our true ally in the region, has been ignored by presidents since 1979. And I don't know the real reason behind that. Once we do an interview, we'll find I have people in mind. We'll talk to you about this and get, that's my impression. This is what I think has happened. So President-elect Donald Trump ended up talking to the president of Taiwan, which was shocking to the left. Shocking, shocking, I say. This democratic Republic of Taiwan, who has much more in common with us than communist China, but it's much smaller. China wants to retake Taiwan, swallow it up, claims it's still part of China. It's an ongoing, decades-old conflict. Well, President-elect Trump talked to the president of Taiwan. He thought the world would have ended. Mike Pence, Vice President-elect Mike Pence, was on with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, and this is how the conversation went.
During the course of the transition 8 years ago, President Obama, it's reported, spoke to 22 world leaders. And
he did not
speak
to the leader of Taiwan. That's what I'm trying to
figure out. More than 50. I have to tell you, George, it's a little mystifying to me that President Obama can reach out to a murdering dictator in Cuba in the last year and be hailed as a hero for doing it. And President-elect Donald Trump takes a courtesy call from a democratically elected leader in Taiwan, and it's become something of a controversy.
How good. Touche, Michael Pence. I mean, that really was a great comeback. You know, there's a lot of blowback since the election, needless to say. If I had time, I would talk to you about the attacks on the various appointments by President-elect Trump, and I'll get to that maybe on a different day, maybe in the last segment today. But if I don't, you have to know that, you know, the left is not going down quietly. In fact, we're going to talk to Hans von Spakovsky in a few minutes about that recount effort and about the intimidation of the electors from the Electoral College. But a sidebar, other things are happening. Like Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, they have coined this term fake news because they say that the reason that Trump won was because all this fake news was exchanged on Facebook and people misunderstood who Hillary Clinton was and they got wrong information. And that's why Donald Trump was elected. Fake news. Of course there's fake news on Facebook, but it doesn't, you know, what I have found is that it doesn't take long for people to figure that out. I get stuff like that and then people will go, oh, I found out that's not true. Fake news is their way of discrediting stories and reports about Mrs. Clinton and that actually were true, but it wasn't fake at all. So Mark Zuckerberg is going on this campaign now to start sort of anointing certain news sources and put them on Facebook and put them in everyone's feed so that as opposed to Facebook being just an open forum, Facebook will then sort of like provide you the information that they think you need. That doesn't mean you can't post your own. This is kind of a work in progress, but you can see where they're going with this. And at the same time, leftist organizations are targeting conservatives left and right. Let me briefly say, Kellogg's is blacklisting Breitbart. They're saying that Breitbart News does not reflect their values. Now, of course, Breitbart has 45 million readers a month, 45 million. And Kellogg's, is Pop-Tarts, it's Frosted Flakes, it's Special K, it's Mini Wheats, it's Eggo, it's all kinds of stuff. And they are now blackballing Breitbart for advertising. So Breitbart is in return starting a campaign called hashtag dump Kellogg's. Now, I can tell you right now, I'm dumping Kellogg's. I am not buying Kellogg's. I'm not doing it. There's enough generic stuff out there. You don't need to buy Kellogg's. And I think we have to fight back. That's my personal opinion. I am launching my own personal dump Kellogg's. I'm not going to do this. I am not going to shop with them because they are blackballing all kinds of Americans. How dare they? How dare they? And then we have our fixer-upper, Joanna Gaines and Chip, who are great, my favorites on HGTV. And now there's an attempt by the LGBT activists to get them off of HGTV because they go to a church where the pastor preaches that marriage is between one man and one woman. And so they are intimidating, trying to get HGTV to remove them. Now, this is going to be interesting because Joanna and Chip have already firmly entrenched themselves. Their ratings are great. They are probably one of the most popular shows on HGTV. And yet the leftists cannot tolerate the fact that they simply go to a church where Christ is preached, where marriage, as God ordained it, is preached as between one man and one woman. Joanna and Chip, as far as I know, haven't written anything themselves on this, but now there's a witch hunt to see what they believe and if they agree with their pastor. It is unbelievable. We have to fight back. AFA is facing its own battle. The comptroller of Connecticut wants to ban contributions to the American Family Association from its employees and their charitable payroll deductions. He's a gay man, married, and he's very offended that we are targeting Target. So you see, the assaults are continuing, and so we have to remain vigilant. So I'm all for dumping Kellogg's. I'm all for, by the way, AFA.net, if you want to sign the petition in support of Joanna and Chip Gaines. So more about that when we have more time. But coming up next, What is this recount business all about? And what is the intimidation of the electors intended to do? Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. On Saturday, November 19th, over 9,000 bicyclists assembled in Arizona for El Tour de Tucson, a well-known cycling event in the Tucson, Arizona area. The cyclist to make the fastest time among the female riders was Jillian Bearden, born Jonathan Bearden, later transitioning to a female persona. This obviously raises questions of the fairness of competition, but athletic organizations, including the International Olympic Committee, have sought to address the issue. The OIC's rules require the athlete to have, quote, declared that her gender identity cannot be changed for a minimum of 4 years. Even in the OIC's attempt to be accepting of transgendered people, they highlight the fickle premise of gender identity. You are a man or a woman as God made you to be. Those who are gender confused are best off trusting their Creator's plan and learning what it means to be who God made them. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Here's Dan Celia with today's Stewardship Moment.
The disciples, and it seems like a whole lot of other people, wanted to set their agenda for Jesus. The disciples wanted him to go to the crowds. And of course, we know that the crowds wanted to crown him king. Jesus knew his mission. Jesus knew his agenda. He had an agenda that had been laid before him by the Father. He was not going to compromise the Father's plan. You know, the Father has a plan for us to stay focused on His will, and that should be a part of our stewardship.
You've just heard a Stewardship Moment with Dan Celia of Financial Issues Ministry, helping you plan, give, and invest wisely. For more information, log on to financialissues.org. That's financialissues.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and commentary next. How would you like to finish your degree online? Truett McConnell University makes that possible with their top-notch online program. You can even earn a master's in theology. For 70 years, Truett McConnell University has been preparing students to fulfill God's high calling on their lives, on campus or online. A degree that can not only change your life, but also your workplace. Truett.edu is the website. That's Truett.edu. Many public universities are cracking down on what they consider to be offensive religious decorations, going so far as to ban the baby Jesus. Missouri State University wants people to decorate with flowers or winter scenes or gender-neutral snow people. The college at Brock Park, New York, urges students to use culturally sensitive holiday decorations that are non-specific to any religion. Well, what are they supposed to decorate with? A potted fern? Oregon State University's Office of Equality and Inclusion, paid for by our tax dollars, posted guidelines about inclusiveness and respect so that constitutional obligations might be met. Well, here's a stocking stuffer truth bomb, folks. Christmas is a federal holiday, so deck your halls accordingly. Sweet mercy, America. I'm Todd Stearns.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Statewide recount is no easy task, but right now workers in Wisconsin are recounting 3.5 million votes after Donald Trump flipped the state and won it in the presidential election. Wisconsin state law allows any candidate to request a recount, but he or she must pay for the recount if the loss is more than 0.25% of the vote. Enter Green Party candidate Jill Stein, who filed a lawsuit to challenge the state's results and fronted the $3.5 million for the recount. Then Hillary Clinton's own campaign jumped in to participate in Stein's lawsuit. Now a group of Trump supporters, including two PACs and a private citizen, filed a new lawsuit to stop the recount in Wisconsin, saying it's putting Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes in jeopardy if the recount is not finished by the time electors officially cast their votes on December 17th. The pro-Trump lawsuit also states that because workers are moving at a, quote, quadruple rate to recount these votes, there could be big errors in the new tally. Critics say Jill Stein's efforts are in vain. Wisconsin's own governor, Scott Walker, weighing in, saying, quote, I think a lot of people, no matter where they sit on the political spectrum, kind of scratch their heads on why someone would ask for a recount when they came in fourth, referring to Stein. Now, Stein has also requested a recount in Pennsylvania and Michigan. Trump supporters there also filing lawsuits to stop those recounts. All of this has to be figured out by December 13th, according to federal law.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you. That was a report from Fox this morning. I was like, what's going on here? You know, a Daily Caller reported just last week, in the first day of the recount in Wisconsin, Mrs. Clinton narrowed the gap with Mr. Trump by a single vote. And at noon today, the Michigan recount begins. And let me just give you an idea of what the numbers of the votes are. In Michigan, 10,700 more people voted for Donald Trump. In Wisconsin, 22,000 more people. And in Pennsylvania, 68,000. That's how many votes they'd have to make up in order to change the outcome of the election. Jill Stein won arguably 1% of the vote, if that much. It's a strange situation, and so Hans von Spakovsky is the person to talk to. He is a senior legal fellow at Heritage Foundation, has extensive experience with elections, worked for the FEC for a number of years, and Hans joins us this morning. Hans, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Sandy.
All right, so Hans, I've heard a lot of speculation about why Jill Stein is doing this. I want to know what you think.
I think, frankly, it gets her the attention that she didn't get during the election. I mean, look at it this way. During the election, she was only able to raise a little under $3 million. So these are all the people who wanted her to run and win the presidency. During the recount, she's gotten far more media attention than she ever got before, plus she has raised, I think at the last count, upwards of $7 million for the recount. So she gets time in the media. She gets money coming in, even though this recount is a complete and total waste of time because there's absolutely no chance that she can get enough votes to win.
Well, the thing that doesn't make sense to me is that the Clinton camp joined in this effort. But they, at the same time, acted and said publicly, oh, we don't want to do this. We really don't. But they did join. Did they have to join? Did they have to be part of this? What was that all about?
I think that is more of a strategy to make Donald Trump look like he was an illegitimate winner. He doesn't have a mandate. He should never be president. You have to remember this. The lawyer for Hillary Clinton is a guy named Mark Elias. Mark Elias is the leading Democratic lawyer in Washington, D.C. He represents the DNC, and almost all Democratic candidates go to him and his law firm. He's also the lawyer who managed to take a losing candidate back in 2008 in Minnesota, Senator Al Franken, and turn him into a winner during the recount. And I think part of this is to do as much as they can to damage Donald Trump, because that's going to be part of their fight for the next 2 years until the congressional elections and the next 4 years until the presidential election.
Well, I think that that's true. I also find myself thinking, Hans, that, Mrs. Clinton made a campaign of talking about how horrifying it would be if President Trump did not accept the results of the election. So if she were to challenge the election, and she'd be the likely person to do it because she's the one who won the popular vote by 1 million votes or 2 million votes and is losing in the Electoral College, she would be the likely challenger. But if she did that, it would be so hypocritical. I actually find myself wondering if Jill Stein is not the shill here, where they're putting her up to do this, but it really is ultimately on behalf of Mrs. Clinton.
Oh, look, I actually agree with that, even if they haven't talked directly, because, look, since she could only raise $3 million during the presidential campaign, there's no way she could raise $7 million for the recount. It is Democratic donors, obviously, who are funding funding this recount. So it's really true that she is acting as a shill for the Hillary Clinton campaign.
All right, so we have three states. We've got Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Now, let's talk about each of them because it's a little confusing and everyone's different. So Wisconsin, there was some ruling by a judge that they wouldn't do a hand recount. What's the story there?
In Wisconsin, actually, it is up to the ballot board commissions in each county. These are the officials who run the elections in each county. They can decide on their own whether or not to do a hand count or to use the machine to count the elections like happens on election day. And apparently they went to court, Jill Stein's campaign, trying to force everyone in the entire state, all counties, to only do a hand count.
All right, so where does that stand now?
I think my understanding is it's up to each county as to what they want to do. So some places are doing hand counts.
Oh, boy.
others do machines. It is, like I said, it is a complete and total waste of time because of the fact that she lost by so much. Look, in the last two decades, there have been a little more than two dozen statewide recounts across the nation. In only three cases did it overturn the election, and in each of those cases, the margin of victory between the two candidates to start with was only a couple of hundred votes. You can't change 20,000 votes.
Yeah, but they're trying, of course. But I do think it's all about perception. I don't know. Now in Michigan, they're starting today at noon. What's the difference in Michigan between how Wisconsin's being handled?
You know, there really isn't that much difference between all of these states. The technical details vary, but in essence, what a recount means is that you're not simply recounting the ballots. In Wisconsin, for example, and other states too, the rules lay out that you can also reconsider votes that may not have been counted. So, for example, if an absentee ballot, election officials decided not to count it, because they say that it didn't comply with state law, that can be reconsidered. And in fact, I should tell you, and one of the reasons this is somewhat dangerous is, look, back in 2008, one of the ways that Mark Elias turned Al Franken from a loser into a winner was that in democratically controlled counties, they basically changed the rules and said, well, as long as the absentee ballot substantially complied with state law, will count it, whereas the Republican-controlled counties went strictly by the law and said, if it doesn't comply with the law, we're not going to count it. And that was one of the ways they upped the Democratic votes in that election.
Yeah, so we are on dangerous ground. I know, and you know, the other thing that made me a little nervous is that Jill Stein reported over the weekend that she was changing her tactic in Pennsylvania to appeal to a federal court. Well, that immediately made the antenna go up. So what do you know about that part of it?
Well, apparently she missed the deadline for asking for a recount in Pennsylvania. There's a state statute that gives candidates a certain amount of time to ask for a recount. My understanding is she missed it by a day. So she's now going to federal court and, in essence, asking a federal judge to override and ignore the state law deadline.
So what is the danger here, Hans? Spell it out. I mean, what could happen? Worst case scenario, could this really unseat Donald Trump as the president-elect?
I don't believe so. If they could overturn one state, that still wouldn't make Hillary Clinton the winner. As you know, the closest state is the 22,000 vote. 22,000 vote difference in one state. We've got, 11,000 votes in another. I believe that's Michigan. I don't think they can even get one state changed. I think they'd have to get two states changed, maybe to get close to being a winner. But psychologically, I think they want to do everything they can to diminish Donald Trump's victory and say he had no mandate. By the way, I would point out to folks, particularly on the Democratic side, who keep saying, well, the 46, 47% of the vote that Donald Trump got says he obviously doesn't have a mandate because he didn't have after 50%. Actually, that gives him a higher mandate than Bill Clinton had when he was elected in his first election. Remember back then, Bill Clinton only had 43% of the vote and he was elected president.
Wow. Hans, before we get to the break, I want to ask you if you could stay with me another segment, because I'd like to talk about the Electoral College longer, but I want to ask you now so that I don't run out of time. Can you?
Sure, happy to do it.
Okay, good. Well, then let's go back to this. The Electoral College, let's at least start talking about this. This is so controversial. I think the best explanation I have of how to make this clear to people is this. This is written by someone, I think it was for Alan West's website. There are 3,141 counties in the United States. Trump won 3,084 of them, Clinton, 57. There are 62 counties in New York State. Trump won 46 of them, Clinton won 16. Clinton won the popular vote by approximately 1.5 million votes. But in the five counties that encompass New York City, Bronx, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Richmond, and Queens, Clinton received well under 2 million votes more than Trump. Clinton only won four of these counties. Trump won Richmond. Therefore, these five counties alone, the ones in New York City, more than accounted for Clinton winning the popular vote of the entire country. These five counties in New York comprise 319 square miles. The United States is comprised of 3,797,000 square miles. And when you have a country that encompasses almost 4 million square miles of territory, it would be ludicrous to even suggest that the vote of those who inhabit a mere 319 square miles should dictate the outcome of a national election. I think that's very cool. But Hans, expand on this. What did the founding fathers had in mind that a dense, small area would not control the whole country? This was a balance of power. I'd love to know what your thoughts are on why they laid out an electoral college.
Well, actually, that description lays it out very well. If you look back at the notes of the Constitutional Convention, it's very clear that they were afraid that if a president were elected purely on national popular vote, then what you would get is exactly what happened in this election. A candidate would be elected who only went to and campaigned in the large urban cities and population centers, would ignore the rest of the country, the more rural areas, the places with less population, and they did not want a candidate that had such shallow coverage, shallow support from the American people. They wanted someone who won regional contests throughout the country because we are a large country and are very different in many parts. And this election proves that their vision was a good one and a correct one. Listen, you can drive from the East Coast to the West Coast, from the northern border to the southern border of the United States, and never drive through a single county that had supported Hillary Clinton.
You know, I just coming from a blue state, Illinois, Hans, all of those that come from those kinds of states, I guess New York would be an example of that, too, where one city center, New York City or Chicago, in our case, would control a state, just absolutely control it. Everything is centric there because of all the money and the population. Wonder why the states didn't adopt some sort of an electoral college approach to their elections.
Well, they actually used to do that. In the southern states, they used to have what they called a county system. And in Alabama, for example, counties in the state, no matter how small their populations, were guaranteed, you know, at least one representative in the state legislature. That all ended in the early 1960s when the U.S. Supreme Court established under the one-person, one-man vote rule and said that, no, you can't do that. Both of your chambers and the state legislatures have to be based entirely population. When the states argued, for example, that, well, why can't we have at least one chamber that models the U.S. Senate, which guarantees every state, no matter how small, at least two representatives. The Supreme Court just arbitrarily said, oh, no, you can't do that.
And then see, the result is these states have gone blue because so many people are centered in these very large cities and the rest of the people in the states really have no say. I've certainly seen that happen in Illinois. Hans von Spakovsky is my guest. You know, the electors have been terribly threatened. And we haven't really discussed that very much, but Hans has written an article about it. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what that means and why it is really and truly illegal. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Hi, this is Steve Tiber, president, co-founder of 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope was meant to be a one-time trip to Bay St. Louis, Waveland, Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina. And then God got involved. And since then, we have been to 9 different states, rebuilt 1,700 homes, and it's all because we love Jesus. God tells us to love Him and love others. And that's what we do, either through 8 Days of Hope or a new ministry called Hope Reigns. Hope Reigns goes immediately after disaster, a tornado, a flood, a fire, a snowstorm. But what we noticed with disasters is right after disaster, there's so many ministry opportunities. We've already been to New York, Illinois, Tennessee, Texas. So if someone's interested in 8 Days of Hope or Hope Reigns, the best place to go is our website, 8daysofhope.com. And even though we might not have an event planned the day you go to the website, if you give us your email address on our website, we'll be able to contact you about future events.
Dysfunction in Washington is not the problem. The real issue is a lack of leadership.
When it comes to economic policy, our government seems to be out of control, and Christians could have a role in restoring it.
Christians will change the direction of America if we step up.
Visit afastore.net to find the DVD Surviving Government Economic Policies with Dan Celia, as well as all the resources of the AFA Cultural Institute.
On the next Today's Issues, the ripple effect is still being felt by everyone, including political candidates in other countries.
And they're all talking about the Trump factor. They're bringing it into their political equation. So Donald Trump may actually have more of an impact on the world than Barack Obama did.
Well, he defied the odds.
Enlightenment and analysis on the next Today's Issues, weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on AFR and online at AFR.net.
We are going to the Holy Land in March. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. I only lead one tour a year to Israel. It's not my day job. It's just an annual tour that I do as I learn from my dad how to take folks to Israel. And we're going to have a wonderful experience. Most of the folks going are listeners to American Family Radio or supporters of American Family Association. And we're going to have a great time March 9th through the 17th. If you want information on this tour of the Holy Land, you can do it two ways. You can call us at 800-FAMILIES, option 5. 1-800-FAMILIES, option 5. That's families with an S. And leave us your name and your address, and we'll put a brochure in the mail to you. And if you want to go online, you can visit us at twholyland.com. twholyland.com. Again, won't be long till we close out this tour, so if you want more information, let us know.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. With a phone call Friday, Donald Trump fired what might be called the shot across the bow heard round the world. The president-elect had a call with Taiwan's president, the first such contact since 1979 when Jimmy Carter appeased communist China by cutting off formal relations with the island it covets. Heads have been exploding ever since, particularly among the political and media elites. Predictably, the thugs in Beijing have complained bitterly, encouraging the narrative that an inexperienced Trump could blunder needlessly into a conflict with the Chinese. I remember vividly similar hysterics when another transformative figure, President Ronald Reagan, in 1983, declared that he'd explore the option of defending America against missile attack. The Reagan Initiative helped defeat the Soviet Union without firing a shot. Trump's may just set the stage for similarly undoing another dangerous communist regime in China. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Being selected as an official elector is a big responsibility. It also comes with hardships. That is especially true for Michael Benarian. He is a college student from Michigan who will cast his electoral vote for President-elect Donald Trump, and he's joining us now. Michael, thank you for taking the time out. We do appreciate this. And I understand that you have received some messages, obviously some lobbying from people. You've also received threats. Tell us about them.
Yeah, and thanks for having me, by the way. I appreciate it. Yeah, so obviously this election cycle was pretty divisive, and unfortunately, it's bled over into the weeks following the election, and I've just been inundated with some death threats, death wishes, generally angry messages trying to get me to change my vote to Hillary Clinton or another person. And unfortunately, you know, it's just gotten a little out of control.
But in Michigan, I mean, aren't you required by law as an elector, or the body of the 16 electors are required to cast their votes in a certain way? It's not as if you have discretion here, right?
Yeah, that's correct. If people would just Google it, I think they'd know a little bit more about the process. In the state of Michigan, we have laws that prevent faithless electors. And so essentially what happens is if I try to vote for somebody else, which to be clear, I don't want to, but if I tried to, I'd just be removed and replaced by another elector. So it's really a pointless endeavor.
What have people said to you? What are the threats?
Well, I've had people talk about putting a bullet in the back of my mouth. I've had these death wishes of people just saying, I hope you die, or do society a favor, throw yourself in front of a bus. Just a lot of angry messages. And unfortunately, I think a lot of these people don't understand that threats over the internet are threats. It's just because you're behind a keyboard doesn't mean that they're not legitimate. And so I would hope that people would start to realize that, and also realize that, again, as electors from Michigan specifically, we don't even have the power to change our votes.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you. That was CNN, and that was, they were interviewing Michael Benarian, as you heard, an elector from Michigan. And we're hearing all over the country that electors are being threatened. Terrible things are being said to them. My guest, Hans von Spakovsky with the Heritage Foundation, has written an interesting article about this, tracing how this all started and asking the question why the Justice Department isn't doing anything about it. Hans, where did this start, this whole cycle of threatening electors? Where did this get its origin in this election cycle?
Well, there was a group of progressive liberal activists, apparently supporters of Hillary Clinton, who put together a group. They've got their own Twitter handle, and they started distributing the contact information for these electors, but only the electors who were Trump electors in Republican states. So they basically directly contributed to spreading out this contact information and giving people the ability to threaten these Trump electors. Now, you know, they've never said they wanted people threatened, but they did say they wanted people held accountable for voting for Trump. So they clearly were encouraging this kind of behavior.
I think I read that one of the electors in Texas actually has dropped out because he'd gotten such frightening threats. And there are lots of people. You gave several examples in your article. Give us some examples of what people are hearing, these electors, what they're experiencing.
Well, they're getting death threats. They're getting death threats from folks telling them that they'd better change their vote, that they shouldn't vote for Trump, and that bad things will happen to them if they don't do that. And what's amazing about all this is that, look, this is a direct, outright violation of federal law. Section 11B of the Voting Rights Act bans the coercion, harassment, intimidation of anyone for voting or attempting to vote. And that's obviously what is going on here. The U.S. Justice Department has jurisdiction over that provision, and I do not understand, other than political reasons, why in the world the Justice Department isn't right now investigating and going to court to prosecute the individuals who are doing this.
You know, Hans, just to kind of flesh this out, it's Texas, it's Arizona, Michigan, we just heard from Michael Benarian, Georgia and Idaho. You say the threats have been so extreme that the secretaries of state in both released statements calling for the harassment to end. But right. The U.S. Department of Justice has done nothing. And you trace this back to the case with the new Black Panthers in Philadelphia. Boy, do I remember that well. That's when J. Christian Anderson left the Justice Department over that. Explain the tie there.
Well, the tie is that right before the Obama administration came in, really the last days of the Bush administration, they filed a civil rights lawsuit under Section 11B against the New Black Panther Party. People, I'm sure, remember the video. These New Black Panthers were standing in paramilitary black uniforms in front of a polling place. One of them had a nightstick. They were yelling racial epithets at voters and poll watchers coming in. The Obama administration, almost as soon as they came in, ordered the case dismissed, even though, if you can believe this, the New Black Panthers failed to answer the lawsuit, meaning they automatically lose. And yet the Obama administration ordered it dismissed. Well, the reason for that was very clear. J. Christian Adams has written about this, because they did not want, the Obama folks did not want the Voting Rights Act, this provision, enforced against black defendants who were violating the law. And I think the same thing, frankly, is going on here. They do not want to enforce the law against progressive liberals, against Democrats. You and I both know, Sandy, that if the situation were the exact opposite, if, in fact, the situation was reversed and it was Trump supporters who were threatening Hillary Clinton electors, you know that the Justice Department would be in court all over the country over this.
Well, and that's why, of course, it's just been an amazing thing to watch, Hans. Who would have ever thought that the Justice Department could become so corrupt in really so short a time, so that they are, justice has not blind now. Justice is not blind at all. Justice has an axe to grind. Eric Holder started it. I will never forget that initial speech he made where he said that we are race cowards. And remember when he said that, cowards on race? Back in 2008, it was like race relations were in such a better place then that I think many of us thought, what? Huh? What's he talking about? We had no idea what we were in store for with this Justice Department. And there is a new sheriff in town. And so if Attorney General Jeff Sessions becomes the Attorney General, how do you see this being different?
I think what will be different is that he will do what the Attorney General is supposed to do, which is enforce the law in a nonpartisan, nonpolitical manner. And when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, enforce it in a race-neutral manner. The Voting Rights Act protects all voters from threats, all voters from racial discrimination. It doesn't matter what their race or color. That is not the way the Holder Justice Department and now the Loretta Lynch Justice Department have enforced the law or viewed it.
You know, Hans, we have to say the obvious. I was just thinking as you were talking, this is a basic right in America. The freedom to vote. You know, this is what despotic nations, Venezuela, all over the world, where they have these so-called elections where they hold a gun to people's head or make them go vote or don't let them vote, or there's no freedom. It's all a sham. This is what the rest of the world, the third world, at least experiences. This is not what we should tolerate in America, is the threat or intimidation to voting on anything, whether it's a union vote or an elector or a presidential. We have the freedom to cast our ballot in our own, with our own conscience, and that's something that's well worth fighting for.
Oh, look, I couldn't agree more wholeheartedly. I'm a son of immigrants. My mother grew up in Nazi Germany. My father escaped the communists twice. He was a Russian, and my parents always said to me as I was growing up that the most precious thing in America was the ability to go vote in an election in which you had the ability, free from threat, to choose who was going to lead the country. That is our greatest liberty, and it's the one all our other freedoms depend on.
Let me just say that Hans's article is threatening electors violates federal law, so why isn't Loretta Lynch doing anything about it? And we're going to put this on our Facebook page so you can so that you can access it and read it and share it, because it's something you need to know about. I want to shift our conversation just a little bit, Hans. The whole issue of voting, and then, of course, of making sure that our voting process is what it should be, that it's only citizens that are voting. We've talked a great deal about this, whether it be, you know, having to show legal ID. You've been on the front lines of that for a long time. You know, Donald Trump said, has said many times since the election, that millions of people voted illegally. Illegal immigrants, I think, is what he said. Or maybe he said millions of people voted illegally. I'm not sure if he said immigrants. Let's talk about that for a second, because is there any reason, I have my own answer, but you're the expert. Is there any reason to believe that numbers of illegal immigrants actually voted in this last election, and how would we know?
There is evidence that non-citizens, both legal and illegal, voted in this last election because they've been voting in elections now in America for quite some time. We have cases from all over the country, almost all of them cases in which it was only accidentally discovered that the non-citizen was voting. How big of a problem is it? That's more difficult to say because of the fact that we only have an honor system. And when someone registers to vote and asserts they're a U.S. citizen, election officials don't check that. They don't verify it. So it's easy for non-citizens to do this, to get away with it, to not be detected. How big is the problem? Just before the election, the Public Interest Legal Foundation, which is headed by Christian Adams, they released a report. They had asked 8 counties in Virginia, well, have you got any non-citizens on the rolls? The counties answered, well, yes, we recently removed more than 1,000 non-citizens from the rolls, many of whom had voted in prior elections. This is just in 8 counties. We don't know how many more there are in the more than 100 other counties in Virginia. A number of surveys have been done in which non-citizens admit they are registered to vote. And based on those surveys, I know of at least 3, I would estimate that anywhere between 10 and 15% of the non-citizens in the country are registered to vote. And in an average election, anywhere from 2 to over 6% of them are voting. How big are those numbers? Well, there's about 12 million illegals in the country, and there's about 12 to 13 million legal non-citizens. So that's about 25 million people. Even only 5% of that, that's hundreds of thousands of people who are voting illegally.
You know, I was thinking about Los Angeles. I heard a stat that they have 500,000 illegal immigrants in L.A. alone. And they are a sanctuary city, which is another article that you just wrote that I want people to be able to have access to. It's havens for alien criminals should lose federal funding. And we're going to put this on our Facebook page. But the point is that if they don't make illegal immigrants who are criminals, if they do not allow them to be reported to the federal government, why wouldn't they allow them to vote? Why would they even check that? I mean, there's great danger in these sanctuary cities, don't you think, Hans?
Oh, there most certainly is. And in fact, the Obama administration has made it very clear they don't want anything done about this voting problem. They have gone to court to prevent states from verifying the citizenship of registered voters. Now, you got to ask, why in the world would they do that when it is a felony under federal law to register and vote if you're a non-citizen? There's only one answer. They want non-citizens registering, they want them voting, and they don't want them deterred or detected from doing that. Why? Well, because the Obama administration thinks politically it will help them get their Democratic candidates elected.
Hans, we're running out of time, but in that race with Al Franken, to go back to that, wasn't there suspicion that it was illegal voters that possibly pushed Al Franken over?
Oh yeah, one of the surveys estimated that in the 08 election, about 6.5% of the non-citizens in the country voted. In Minnesota, that would have been enough to throw the race to Al Franken.
Yeah, so you see, it does have consequences. And by the way, we'll put that article about sanctuary cities that Hans just wrote also on our Facebook page. Both of these articles, invaluable information. And Hans, an invaluable encyclopedia of information himself. Thanks for joining us, Hans von Spakovsky.
Thank you for having me, Sandy.
All right. This has been Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk. Thanks for joining.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.